I'm talking to you about just another checklist. Bit of an odd title, right? So let me explain. But first of all, I want to say it's great to be back. It feels really weird actually sitting down there knowing that I'm not running up to give a notice or do something silly with Mark in terms of the box or whatever. But yeah, it is awesome to be back and see all your lovely faces again. Not the box. What was the question box? The question box. What was it called? Was it called? Okay, let's see. The box. The question box. I'm sorry. Leave me alone. Oh, dear. No, we're not talking about that drinking game again. That's not okay. Anyway, now, when Mark came to speak to me about potentially coming back to speak to you guys, I was thrilled at the chance. But I didn't really know what to talk about. And so Mark gave me the brief to come and speak to you about something that was a little Christmassy, potentially with something to do with prophecy in the Nativity. So I was like, okay, that's interesting. What can I do this on? And so I remembered that last year, Mark was talking about the Nativity being the story that was foretold. Next slide, please, Nick. That was the slide he used last year in his presentation for those of you who were here. And Mark doesn't remember it at all. Clearly, it makes a bigger impact on me than it does on him. But as soon as I went to the website to find out what he said, actually. Funnily enough, this talk isn't on the website, but there are loads of other talks on there that are absolutely great value for money, and I suggest you check them out. But what I do know he spoke about is how, actually, in the Old Testament, there are plenty of things that predict the story of Jesus in the New Testament, especially about his nativity. But I wanted to make sure, by checking this talk out, that I didn't actually repeat too much of what he had to say. So while I don't know exactly what I said, I do know that often at this point, he goes to one of his favorite statistics. This isn't one about Liverpool winning X number of trophies, but actually it's about the random chance of a random person fulfilling the prophecies that can be attributed to Jesus. So, did you know that if only 8 of the prophecies about the Messiah were fulfilled by a random person, the chance of this happening, this is completely a chance, are 1 in 10 to the 17. That is, I think that's 10 with 17 zeros afterwards, or is it 1 with 60, with 80, with 17 zeros after it? TC, I'm looking at you here. Is that right? Basically, it's a really big number that is really unlikely to have happened. And if anyone wants to check my source, I got the number from a book called Science Speaks. So if you want to go away and have a Google, that's where I got the number from. And I could stand here and tell you all about how they got this number, all the calculations they did, but that's not really why I'm here. I'm here to talk to you explicitly about the prophecies that we see fulfilled in the Nativity stories. Because, you know, it's nearly Christmas. And what's Christmas without looking at the Nativity story? So, first and foremost, what are these prophecies? Now, there are only 2 birth narratives in the Gospels, right? So there's one in Luke and there's one in Matthew. And I have a little table. Nick, next slide. Thank you. With all of these prophecies on, that are fulfilled in these 2 narratives. So let me just talk you through my little table that I made. So first and foremost, we have the prophecy column. This is the action that Jesus is deemed to have fulfilled in the gospel. So as you can see there's quite a list. There's him being born in Bethlehem. There's him coming from a virgin and being called Emmanuel. There's the fact that he would go to Egypt and the fact that there'd be a massacre of children in the town where he was born. So, you know, these are pretty interesting things in and of themselves. The second column is all about where this prophecy can be found in the Old Testament. So as you can see, most of these are from the prophets. So you've got people like Micah there, you've got people like Isaiah, Hosea, Jeremiah. But you've also got Genesis there, which is quite interesting. And finally, the final column is all about the fulfillment. Where do we see this prophecy actually fulfilled in the New Testament? So when you look at that table, you notice there's a lot of Matthew there, right? Is anyone a bit intrigued as to why there's a load of Matthew there? Anyone got any ideas why Matthew may be so common on that table? No? TC?
You said Matthew and Luke were the only 2 with the birth narrative, so a lot of the predictions are to do with the birth, so it would be likely to have a lot of them?
True, but why aren't they also in Luke? So all of them, so every time they're in both, I've put both up there. So why is it that Matthew is a bit more critical when it comes to this kind of thing. Why is he so keen to point out this is a fulfillment of prophecy? Okay, well, the idea is that Matthew wrote his gospel to Jews. So his gospel is all about telling the Jews that Jesus is the Messiah, the one they've been waiting for. And actually, all these points of prophecy are Matthew pointing out to the Jews that, look, this guy's fulfilling the prophecy. This is the guy that we've been waiting for. Going back to that statistic earlier, the Jews know that if someone's fulfilling these by random chance, it's very, very, very unlikely. So actually, chances are that the guy who's fulfilling these prophecies is the one they've been waiting for. And when we think about it, this sounds pretty simple on the surface, doesn't it? We think, okay, that's the reason they're in there. That's the reason in the Gospels that we have these prophecies, that they're pointing out that this Jesus guy is the Messiah that we're waiting for. This is the guy that's been promised to the Gentiles, who's going to bring them into the salvation that God has promised Israel. That's it, isn't it? That's the only reason they're there. It'd be great if it was that simple, but it's not. And actually, I think it's pretty glorious that it's not that simple, and I'm going to explain why as we go through. Excuse me. So, let's actually look at the prophecies themselves and try and understand why it is that these are the things prophesied, rather than actually just saying, okay, well, he ticks the box. That's what it's about, right? It only matters that he ticks tick the box. Why are these boxes there in the first place? What are they all about? So, let's jump in with the first one, shall we? The Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. Now, this is taken from somewhere in Micah, as you can see by the table. And Micah 5, 2-4 actually says, "But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times. He will stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they will live securely, for then his greatness will reach to the ends of the earth." Now, what's really interesting about that little passage of scripture is that it draws out that Bethlehem is, I'm just going to read it again, small among the clans of Judah. It's tiny. It's insignificant. But actually, this is something we see replicated throughout the Bible time and time again, isn't it? That God takes the weak, he takes the small, and makes them strong, and uses them for powerful, powerful things. Off the top of my head, I can think of people like David, like Gideon. People who really, no one really should have cared about, no one should have thought anything of, but actually God used them powerfully and used them to lead Israel. David became king and is in fact one of the most celebrated characters in the entire of the Old Testament. You ask the Jews who they look up to most out of the Old Testament characters, David's going to be in the top three easily. And let's jump to another one. Why on earth is it significant that there's a massacre of infants when Jesus is born? Or that he goes and spends time in Egypt. Like, these are really bizarre things. Why on earth would these be significant? Why is it that God's saying, okay, my Messiah has to tick these boxes? What is important about them? And actually, can we think of places where this is reflected in the Old Testament? When has this happened before? Some of you will immediately jump back to the Exodus. What happened to Moses? When Moses was born, there was a massacre of infants. And in fact, the entirety of the Israelites were exiled in Egypt for 400 years when they'd gone there after Joseph and Judah had done all that stuff involving the dreams and the Technicolor dream coat. So if you want, you can go check out Andrew Lloyd Webber's musical. But for a live rendition and what you read in the text. But actually, the connection here is showing that the Messiah has an intrinsic link to the past of Israel. It's showing that he himself understands what it's like to be in exile, that he understands what the people have felt over time. And in fact, some of the prophecies about this Messiah come explicitly from this time of exile. People like Isaiah, people like Jeremiah, Ezekiel, these are people who are writing their passages down in exile. And so they know what it's all about. And that Jesus can intimately relate to this kind of thing is something that is truly valuable to the people of God, because they've been there, they've done it. And actually, this massacre of infants thing links Jesus directly to Moses. And there's a prophecy in Deuteronomy 8:15 that says that God will raise up a leader for the Israelites just like Moses. I could be here forever dissecting these passages, but I think we need to move on. But the point I've hopefully got across is that there are all these themes and subtle ideas that permeate throughout the Bible, so that we can't just see it as a book of facts, that the Gospels aren't just a tick sheet saying, yep, Jesus is the man, fantastic. It's more than that. Actually, what's going on here is the careful weaving of a story that goes right from the beginning of time, right through the Gospels, and right through the end. That this is, it's just so important to see that this is not an isolated event, but it's actually tied in with the entirety of history that's gone before it. Now, some of you will immediately go, hold on a minute. Sam, that's not how we learn about fact. That's not how we learn about things that happened. We're given textbooks in school in some subjects like maths and science and even history. And these things, bullet point things that we need to learn, and we learn them. Stories, they're fun to read and all, but, you know, they're not factual. They don't give us anything useful. I'd like to challenge that perception. I mean, if you think back to some of the books you may have read in English, when I was at school, we read through stuff like Frankenstein and all this kind of stuff. And on the surface, you think, well, that's just a horror story. But actually, there's so much more to it. Some of you may have heard of George Orwell. So you're thinking Animal Farm, 1984. Something that may be a bit more contemporary to you guys is Philip Pullman's Dark Materials saga. So the three books, so The Amber Spyglass, The Subtle Knife, and the Golden Compass, that movie that came out a few years ago now, and they never ever made the sequels because nobody went to see it. But but basically, the idea is that each of these things has behind it a view that the author is trying to get across. They're trying to tell you something behind the narrative. They're merely using the story as a means to convey their point to you. Let's take Frankenstein, for example. I don't know if you guys have ever read it or seen a movie, but actually the character of the monster is really well written, and he's human. You sort of really empathize with him, and you can't really just, you feel nothing but pity for him. And it's a really well written story, but actually what Mary Shelley, the author, is trying to tell you throughout all of this is she's questioning scientific advances. She's saying, should we really get to the point where we're playing God? And she's actually using the story, the narrative, to do that. She's getting you to think that while you're reading through this book. Excuse me. I think that's an amazing skill that authors have, and actually I think that's something we should place in huge value in, because it's actually a great way to get you to think about things. I mean, let's be honest. How many of you have actually read through a textbook cover to cover in one sitting? Not one sitting, but have you actually read through a textbook cover to cover? Really? You've actually sat down and read through a textbook? Did you enjoy sitting and reading the textbook? No. No. Quite. Exactly. So that's great, because you read through a textbook, you learn a lot of stuff, but actually it's really hard work. And actually there's a real skill in being able to weave your sort of point of view, your understanding, into a narrative. And actually that's what God is doing in the Bible. He's actually weaving deep truths about himself into himself, even into a narrative. And I think it's really important that actually we appreciate that. And I'll come back to that at the end. But also, and because it's Christmas, my thoughts immediately turn to penguins as well, because I remember Mark's talk from the service last year where he brought his toy penguin in and started showing it around. It was good. But the key point I want to bring in here is documentaries. Now, these are pieces of movie or books that try and tell us something factual, something that's informational. And actually, nowadays, they're going towards the narrative. And you'll get my penguins reference in a minute. Does anyone remember March of the Penguins?
Yeah.
So, March of the Penguins, for those who don't know, is a film about the penguin migration from the sea to their breeding ground every single year. And what they do is they get Morgan Freeman to narrate it, and they craft this story about these penguins. They craft this story about, which is something about something that we really shouldn't care about. We read about it and go, okay, they go there to make eggs. That's what they're doing, and have chicks. That's what they're doing. But actually, they craft this story so well that actually you start to develop feelings for these penguins. You start to develop, not in that way. You start to you start to develop affection for the penguins in the sense that, oh my goodness, you're going through such hardship. I recognize that you're suffering in what you're going through. And it's crazy because you think, I don't care about these birds. They're just penguins. I shouldn't care about these birds that are a million miles away that have nothing to do with me. But actually, you feel compelled to care. And actually, there's a real part of this in the nativity narratives that we miss. There's an innately human story going on there that we also miss if we just treat it as a tick box. So I've reconstructed the narrative slightly. So it's slightly less Bible, but I want to read you my reconstruction and see if you can get what I'm getting at here. So when we read the nativity, we're confronted by a carpenter who learns his fiancée is pregnant. Now, no doubt his fiancée has come to him and tried to explain what happened, but he doesn't believe her. But he cares enough for this young girl to try and make sure that the community doesn't vilify her and alienate her because she's done something which is so against the cultural norm at the time. I mean, you can't be doing those kind of things outside of marriage in first century Palestine. It's just not going to work out for you. He then experiences a dramatic change of mind and then marries his fiancée, despite the fact that everyone can put two and two together and work out that however far along she is, it doesn't coincide with the date of their marriage. Then what happens is this global authority figure issues a decree that means they then have to leave their hometown and head all the way to Bethlehem. The fiancée is heavily pregnant at this stage, and it's a horrible, horrible journey, miles and miles away on foot. I mean, they may even have had a donkey to make the journey easier on the fiancé. And they get to Bethlehem, and the inns are full. There's no room for them anywhere. And then one innkeeper, after opening the door and telling them there's no room, as they go to turn away, obviously some pity strikes him then and there, and goes, well, I may not have any room in the inn, but actually I've got a bit of room in a stable out back, if that's okay. And the couple, knowing there's nothing better going, accept it. And funnily enough, this happens to be the time where the woman gives birth. And so she's giving birth on straw, surrounded by probably what is quite a disgusting smell of animal manure and everything else that lies in a stable. And that's the nativity story. That is what you read in the nativity. And sort of, how can you not feel pity for Mary and Joseph? How can you not sort of go, oh my goodness, that's horrible. What a horrible experience to have to go through. And so there's human elements in there that we should innately sort of empathize with. But actually, that's not the full story again. Because if we start taking out the miraculous, then what we're dealing with here is just something that belongs in a serial drama. I mean, you could watch something like this on the BBC. You know, it's something in Coronation Street's ITV, isn't it? It's Emmerdale. Is it Emmerdale? Not Emmerdale. I don't know. Anyway, EastEnders, that's the one. I don't know why I had Emmerdale. They both begin with E. But that's basically what you'll be seeing. So what I want to say to you is actually, there is something so very valuable about the miraculous elements in the nativity story, because actually without them, we're reading something that, while it tugs at our heartstrings, it's not actually something that's all that meaningful. And the tension that this develops is that while we need to see this as a glorious story of almost mythic proportions, of a story that is a really fantastic story, we also have to remember that there's deeply ingrained with it this real historical truth that this event genuinely happened. And I'm going to go to a man who is far more eloquent than I am, just to express this a bit better. So C.S. Lewis, the renowned writer of Narnia and loads of other apologetic works, sort of sets this down. And I'll explain some of the more complicated words in it just after I finish reading it. So he says, "The heart of Christianity is a myth, which is also a fact." Actually, I should also preface this by saying this is more about the resurrection and the death of Christ than it is about the nativity. But I think the points are exactly the same and can count to, can go towards any part of Jesus' story. The heart of Christianity is a myth, which is also a fact. The old myth of the dying God, without ceasing to be myth, comes down from the heaven of legend and imagination to the earth of history. It happens at a particular date, in a particular place, followed by definable historical consequences. We pass from a mythological figure, dying, nobody knows when or where, to a historical person crucified. It is all in order under Pontius Pilate. By becoming fact, it does not cease to be myth. That is the miracle. To be truly Christian, we must both assent to the historical fact and also receive the myth, fact though it has become, with the same imaginative embrace which we accord to all myths. God is more than a god, not less. If God chooses to be mythopoeic, shall we refuse to be mythopathic? For this is the marriage of heaven and earth, perfect myth and perfect fact, claiming not only our love and our obedience, but also our wonder and delight, addressed to the savage, the child, and the poet, in each one of us, no less than to the moralist, the scholar, and the philosopher. So, first of all, mythopoeic and mythopathic, right? Mythopoeic is an author of stories, basically. That's what Lewis is getting at there. And mythopathic is if you are sort of receptive to the idea of the story. That's basically what he's getting at there. So what Lewis is basically saying is for us to be truly Christian, for us to truly believe that Jesus came and did what he did, we have to see these stories in such a light that they capture our imagination, that we are greatly entertained by them. But also, at the same time, we have to appreciate the hard historical fact that underlies them. And if we don't hold those two things in tension, then actually we're missing something of the glory of God. Because actually, he's the grand narrator. He's the grand crafter of an amazing story that goes far beyond just this gospel. The life of Jesus is often called the greatest story ever told. Actually, I think a better way to name it would be the greatest story that is being told. Because Jesus is still here. He's still going on. But the crux of my talk is basically that when this Christmas you hear the nativity stories read in church, as you will, because we can't not do it, I want you to, rather than just go, okay, this is the stuff that's here because it's true, actually, I want you to really bask in the story aspects of it. I want you to be captivated by the stories of Mary having Gabriel appear to her, of the army of angels that appear to the shepherds, of the wise men that follow the star. I want that to really just sink into you and for you to appreciate that and just revel.